Welcome and thank you very much for joining us for episode 171 of the Blazers Edge podcast presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia, and man, Brandon, as I say that, episode 171, that's a pretty big number. I don't know. Do you think we're a real podcast at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This whole time I've been thinking we're kind of like a Pinocchio podcast made out of wood. But yeah, 171 triple digits, I feel like we're turning into a real boy. If you want to reach out to the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast, wood, human, whatever, you can always hook us up, blazersedgepodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever you are. We'd love to hear from you, whether you have ratings, reviews, or subscription, good, bad, or indifferent. Your opinion matters because it makes the show better.
Joining us this week on the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast is ESPN NBA insider Kevin Pelton. Kevin, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, we're really excited to have you on this week because, you know, I've been a Blazers Edge follower before I was a staff member for 6-7 years. And so I go pretty far back reading the site. And as such, I was a pretty big follower of Dave and Ben Golliver. And I remember you and Ben, you kind of collaborated at times. I remember the D'Antonio wing cast was a very, very early iteration of the Blazers Edge podcast. So I want to start out, Kevin, just kind of asking you, first off, how you got involved in writing about the NBA and how you got to ESPN.
Well, quickly on the D'Antonio Wingcast, I want to marvel at how much the technology and the audio quality has upgraded since the original Blazers Edge podcast. This is a major step forward in that regard. Although I don't know how your Zoom feed is compared to the Wingcast. So my background is, you know, I kind of started writing about the NBA my freshman year of college at the University of Washington. As I'm currently sporting, as you guys can see, but no one listening can see, UW t-shirt. So go Huskies. But basically, I had some free time, was always a big basketball fan and kind of analytical in the way I approached the game. But that year, I really started writing about the Sonics and then the NBA in general, and then started getting into statistical analysis at about the same point, reading people like Dean Oliver and then eventually John Hollinger, who were kind of pioneering this field. So my junior year, after I had done my own Sonics site, in a pre-blog era, it was just like a fan site at that point, I got an internship with the team my last 2 years of college, then got a full-time job working for supersonics.com after that, you know, kind of the doing what Casey Holdall has done for many years for the Blazers, very well for their website. And after the team moved to Oklahoma City, that's when I kind of started doing more national stuff, hooked up with Basketball Prospectus the last year the Sonics were here. Through that, Baseball Prospectus, the mothership to Basketball Prospectus, had a deal with ESPN Insider to provide them some content, and we got kind of carried over to that. So I had done some stuff for Insider, and when John Hollinger left to take a job with the Memphis Grizzlies at the end of 2012, that's when I got the call and was lucky enough to start up at ESPN.
Nice. So you've been there for 4 or 5 years now, and you know, as I mentioned, there was a little bit of crossover work there with Ben Golliver and Blazers Edge and the D'Antonio Wingcast podcast that you guys did. So how did you originally get hooked up with Blazers Edge and working with Ben in general?
Okay, so this is a great story that I probably can't tell often enough. The very first game of the 2008-09 season, I'm going to start coming down to Portland to get my NBA fix after the Sonics have moved. And the Blazers were nice enough to credential me for Basketball Prospectus, and they sent me next to Ben in the kind of upper media row that exists at what was then the Rose Garden and now the Moda Center. And during the game, I pull up Blazers Edge to read about the Martell Webster contract extension that had been signed earlier that day. And Ben takes this as his opening to start harassing me about the fact that I'm reading his website and his story without even having introduced myself. And that was basically the moment. You know, it's been a great friendship ever since. And it was awesome to have a chance to connect with people on Blazers Edge because, you know, the Blazers, I don't have a favorite team. Someone asked me about that in the comments on Blazers Edge the other day because the Sonics are still my favorite team, but definitely the Blazers are kind of the team I follow the closest because I'm down at games so frequently.
You're in Seattle right now. So you're coming down. And when you're, you know, when you're coming to an NBA city to cover any given team, I mean, the closest city to you is going to be Portland. So if you have to cover the Warriors, for example, you're going to, when the Warriors are in Portland, that's where you're going to be to cover that game, right?
Yeah. And, you know, really a lot of it at this point, it's not actually so much like specifically covering for ESPN. Sometimes there's kind of like a long term, you know, some sort of a feature that I'm working on. But, you know, for the most part, it's really just having the opportunity to watch games in person, because I feel like that's just such a much more edifying experience to me than watching a game on TV. And then also the rush of seeing NBA games live. I mean, that's why I fell in love with basketball. So definitely something I wouldn't want to miss. And fortunately, it's just close enough that I can make that trip down and back in a day.
So, I mean, you were looped into the Sonics pretty heavily, obviously, around the time that they were planning to move and then eventually moved. I mean, there have been a couple of, you know, quasi-satirical murmurs at Blazers Edge. Sometimes when things happen and people are like, oh, Paul Allen's going to move the team back to Seattle, right? And so people freak out and this, that, and the other. How was it to live through that, having their team that had been there for, you know, 40-some-odd years since the 60s, to get that ripped away from them? How did that feel? I mean, that must have been beyond devastating for the fans. I just wonder what the emotional temperature was during that time leading up to the decision and then after they ended up moving.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting experience for me because I was going through it kind of on these three different levels. You know, first is a fan who had grown up, had season tickets since I moved into Key Arena up to when I started working for the team. The rest of my family still had those tickets up to when they left, and hopefully we'll have that season ticket priority whenever the team comes back. And so that was one level. Then level two was, is an employee who this was kind of determining my future, and, you know, going, seeing everything from that side of it, and, you know, the going through the rumors and the uncertainty with my other coworkers and friends, that aspect. And then the third aspect of it was like, is a media member, because I'm in there in the locker room as people are asking players questions about this and covering press conferences. So it was a really weird time for certain. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's an emotional wound. I mean, I wouldn't say in some ways fully healed. I mean, I was able to move past it a lot better than most people, because I just love the NBA so much, and it's my career. It's my passion. So, but, you know, I know that for someone like my brother, you know, he doesn't follow the NBA quite as closely still as he did when the Sonics were here. And, you know, the Blazers, I think for a lot of people, have become kind of a secondary team. There was that brief period where it really seemed like the Blazers were making a concerted effort to kind of reach out to Seattle fans when they had a scrimmage at Garfield, Brandon Roy's alma mater during his time with the team when Nate McMillan was there. Now, you know, after it looked like the Kings might move here, that kind of, I think, put the kibosh on that, at least for now. But, you know, they did have the games on the radio here, so that was kind of cool to have last season. But as far as the Blazers moving here, that is not happening. I will squash that rumor definitively at this point.
And speaking of that Sonics and Blazers connection, how does it feel Kevin Clabro coming on as the Blazers TV analyst commentator? I don't know what you call him. I mean, that's gotta be nuts. Cause I mean, he was with Seattle for a super long time, right? Like since the early 90s,
late 80s even. So over 20 years that he spent calling Sonics games. And, you know, one of the cool things about this career and working for the Sonics is that Calabro has become like legitimately a friend who we chat every time we see each other at NBA games. And so I just could not possibly be more excited about it. You know, obviously feel bad about the way it happened and Mike Barrett losing his job, but Calabro is such a good broadcaster and such a good NBA broadcaster. I mean, it was fun to hear him on Pac-12 games, but it's not the same. And even when he's doing national NBA games, I think he talked about this when he was on Locked On Blazers with Eric Gunderson a couple weeks ago. Like, you don't have that same connection as when you're calling a team's games night in and night out. So I'm really excited for the chance to listen to him when I'm watching Blazers games at home. And, you know, I hope Portland fans forgive him for the fact that he's so connected with the Sonics.
Now, we're all pretty stoked to hear Kevin Clabro, and it was recently announced that former Oregon State Beaver Lamar Hurd is going to be joining the broadcast team on television with him as well. So we're really excited about that, but let's jump right into some basketball stuff because it is smack dab in the middle of September right now. We have 6 weeks until the games actually start counting. So there's, you know, we've been talking all summer about the Blazers, but last week in particular, for ESPN, was it ESPN Insider? you mentioned that the Blazers could potentially be a candidate to the bar of success that they set last season. They may not exceed expectations as much as they did last year. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, and you know, I think the way that some Blazers fans took it is I was saying that they're likely to take a step backwards because I think that was kind of misleading on my part because I was making the comparison to the to last year's Milwaukee Bucks, who the previous year had made kind of a, I mean, obviously the Blazers didn't make a jump because they were better the year before, but a similar thing where people weren't thinking of them as a playoff team and they end up outperforming expectations, and then the next year took a step backwards. And to be clear, I don't think that's what's going to happen with Portland. My point was kind of that, you know, I think from Blazers fans, there's a sense of, so a couple of weeks ago we had on Insider the ESPN Real Plus Minus projections that I compiled and projected playing time for everyone. And that has the Blazers at, you know, I think it's between 46 and 47 wins off the top of my head. Between 44 and 45, I guess, should say, actually, a little lower. So, you know, it wouldn't be a step forward from last year when they won 44 games. And I think Blazers fans are looking at that as like, well, that's crazy because, you know, we're all expecting young team. They're going to continue developing, you know, next year. And the baseline is, you know, maybe 47 or 48 wins. And my point was more that, you know, when you have a season like the Blazers did last year, for the most part, things are probably going your way. Injuries being perhaps the most prominent example of that with the Blazers last year. They were really relatively healthy all season. So, you know, they don't just automatically get better, even though they're a young team. Sometimes, you know, you can have better talent even, but still have a worse record. Or in this case, maybe it's a similar record as opposed to a step forward.
And the other thing that's important too, honestly, is the win-loss total at the end of the season isn't nearly as important as whether your team is fully healthy going to the playoffs. So like you said, I mean, with injury variants, if the Blazers are slightly more injured than they were last year, it's definitely conceivable that they, I mean, I think fans should be prepared to possibly deal with a season that the win-loss total doesn't quite add up to what it was last year, even. And even if they may be a better team come playoff time, if everyone's healthy. But I agree with you. I don't think that most fans are prepared for that reality necessarily.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a really interesting case study in the value of expectations and how important they are to kind of determining a fan's enjoyment of the season. Because, you know, if the Blazers go 44 and 38 again, it's not going to feel as exciting as last year did because of the fact that that came so far out of nowhere.
Let's say they had 37 wins last season, 44 wins this year. I think that looks like a logical year number two in the rebuilding progression. And I think it kind of looks like, you know, they set themselves up on this rebuilding track that was kind of parallel to Damian Lillard's contract extension, right? Where you're thinking in the third, fourth, fifth year of that contract that he signed last summer, that might be when they start to really reap the dividends of all the work they did last summer. And I think it kind of looked like they maybe bypassed that first year or two where they're kind of feeling things out and maybe the rebuild. Maybe you're not seeing the results in terms of wins and losses, and you're more, you know, concerned with player development and things like that, as opposed to, you know, getting into the playoffs and having success in the playoffs. And maybe, you know, 44 wins this year, I think that would be a pretty logical year number two to this rebuild.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it that's probably worth bringing up is, you know, everyone was thinking, okay, the Blazers are going to have this ridiculous amount of cap space in the summer of 2016 and are going to be able to do huge things with it. And, you know, they ended up having a solid amount of cap space, but it didn't end up max level, partially because of taking on Anderson Varejao's contract last year, and then also because of the fact that all these guys played so well that all of a sudden, you know, you needed to keep the cap holds for Harkless and Crabb and Leonard and just everyone, you know, basically bringing back everyone. And that left a little less room to go out and be as aggressive in free agency as we might have expected. And then, you know, obviously part of it is that both RPM and I are probably not as enamored of Evan Turner as the Blazers front office is.
So that's an interesting topic of discussion because, you know, looking at this Blazers summer, you know, with the benefit of hindsight now, I think in the moment it was pretty easy to be really disappointed or critical of how things turned out. And, you know, maybe now I'm curious to see, you know, from a national perspective, from somebody who covers the league, being several months, removed from free agency this summer, and seeing how the chips fell and what other teams did, is what the Blazers did this past offseason, is it as underwhelming as it was July 10th, for example?
I think it probably is for me. I mean, the one thing that's maybe, changed is thinking a little bit more about, the fact that the Blazers organization is so excited about this signing. Like, those guys have earned some benefit of the doubt. Neil Olshey's track record as Portland GM has been phenomenal. And, Terry Stotts has done a great job getting the most out of players consistently, last season probably being the greatest testament to that. So, I think they see something in Turner and his ability to run the offense while they can bring guys like McCollum Lillard off the ball and have the element that they had lacked last year in the playoffs, where those two guys were really the only two guys who could make plays other than maybe Mason Plumlee as a passer out of the, especially when Lillard and McCollum were trapped. But it's not like you can throw him the ball and say, hey, make something happen, run the offense. He's not quite at that level, and Turner may be that kind of guy. I just don't think he's really very efficient in that role. It's an interesting contrast, because a few years ago, obviously the Blazers signed Andre Miller in free agency when he was somewhat similarly there. I don't know if it was the plan B or plan C. It was at the same summer as Millsap, but definitely after Hito Turkoglu, they were looking for another creator. And my response to that was, I really like Andre Miller, and I don't think this is a good fit for him because Brandon Roy needs to have the ball in his hands. And I turned out to be wrong. Andre Miller brought something to the table. The difference here is that I thought Andre Miller was a really good player and a bad fit. I am not convinced on the fit in Evan Turner, but I also just don't think he's that good of a player.
And let's not forget that season that there was, for some reason, a battle for the starting point guard between Andre Miller and C. Blake.
There was, for a few months there.
which was odd. I wanted to ask, I know this is somewhat reductionist. I've asked it of other folks before, but you think about this offseason for the Blazers, and let's assume that they didn't have the opportunity to go after a player who was like a Hassan Whiteside or like a Dwight Howard. They didn't have that opportunity. So let's just, and making a lot of assumptions, they had to either use their money to overpay for Evan Turner, or they decided to punt and to deal with all that kind of stuff next year, maybe extend McCollum next year and try to work with that with their cap space next season. Do you think the Blazers would have been any better off doing that? Maybe it's not a fair question to ask if they were to either to spend it just on Evan Turner or save it for next year. But if that's what you're faced with, would you do one of those choices or the other?
I mean, I think this year probably still was the year for the Blazers to spend it, because I think even if you look at McCollum, on that cap hold as opposed to the max extension that he signed, and even if you take Evan Turner off the books, they're still not anywhere all that close to cap space because of the fact that they matched on Crabbe, re-signed Leonard, re-signed Harkless. So you're suddenly talking about probably changing, two or three of those moves. It's not just you're taking Evan Turner off the team. You're also taking, some of those restricted free agents that re-sign off the team if you're actually going to try and use cap space in the summer of 2017. So even though I think that's probably going to be a better value, because it turns out that so many teams used cap space this summer that there's actually going to, maybe probably 15 to 20 teams will have cap space next year, as opposed to the 27 who used it this year. Nate Duncan and Danny LaRue have done a good job making that point on the Dunked On podcast. I still think this was the summer to do it. It was just kind of a question of who. And in fairness, my direction probably would have been to go after a guy like Luol Deng to play that four spot, maybe 3-4, him and Aminu are interchangeable. And I understand if the Blazers thought that, he's older than our core players, we don't want to get that old. If that was their concern, then I can sympathize with that. There was no magic bullet this summer. I'll say that for sure.
Except for there were rumblings that the Blazers were pursuing Pau Gasol. So I mean, if you're making arguments about players being too
That's
old.
True. That's a good point.
Honestly, just to sidetrack real quick, where does that even make sense? Like Pau Gasol signing with the Blazers, which party does that even make sense for, other than Pau Gasol cashing a paycheck?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much it, where it seemed like for a while, if Duncan had come back and San Antonio hadn't had the cap space to sign him to the deal that they had, it really did seem like Powell was kind of going to be stuck, where he was either going to, you know, have to take a deal like that with, a team that probably wasn't as much of an immediate contender as he wanted, or, you know, play for the mid-level exception or something crazy like that. So yeah, he was kind of stuck there. So I can see why it would have made sense for him. But boy, yeah, that definitely seemed like a curious fit for the Blazers, because as talented as Powell remains offensively, he didn't really solve any of the issues you had at the defensive end in terms of rim protection.
No, it was certainly a head scratcher at the time when the rumors came out. And I think, I don't know, speaking for myself and probably quite a few fans, I'm glad that kind of fell through, much like, you know, we mentioned Hedo Turkoglu earlier. That's one we're glad didn't work out. I think probably maybe the Roy Hibbert thing. I mean, looking back now, maybe we're glad that didn't work out.
Sometimes the best moves are the moves that you do not make.
Yeah, yeah.
Or can't make.
Actually, you know, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about looking back on signings that did or didn't happen. And I remember Enes Kanter getting offered the max and restricted free agency for 17.5 or $18 million or something last summer. And at the time, I was like, so glad that the Blazers weren't able to pull that one off, because that's a huge overpay for a guy who doesn't play defense, blah, blah, blah. Now, looking back at the guys who got signed for what they got signed this summer, Kanter's progression with the Thunder last season, I'm not so sure that would have been as horrible a deal if it went through as I originally thought it was a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think my qualms with that deal would have been more the fact that, is Kanter actually better than Ed Davis and Plumlee? I don't know that he is. And, you know, that's one of the things the Blazers did well, is to lock in guys like Davis and Aminu last summer for contracts that have aged tremendously well at this point. The fact that they're declining contracts is so crazy in the context of this massively increasing cap.
Is it fair to say that Al-Farouq Aminu is probably like a top 5 to 10 value contract in the NBA right now?
I mean, like, yeah, if you count out the guys who are kind of, you know, and to cite the Dunked On podcast again, they had like their best and worst contracts since the lockout under the new CBA that they posted a couple months ago. And so, you know, they kind of ruled out guys who are max guys because they're going to get underpaid systemically, like Steph, or, you know, someone like Steph Curry. I guess he probably does qualify on that one because he's way less than max. And then also guys on rookie contracts who are underpaid by definition. So if you take those two categories out of just like good free agent signings, there was a few last summer that were really strong. I mean, Jay Crowder in Boston is along the same lines as Aminu, probably even a little bit better, and I think he might be making less money for longer, so, you know, he's like right up there. But yeah, Aminu, definitely one of the better free agent signings we've seen in recent times.
And if you're thinking about the worst contracts, would you say that Evan Turner was the worst signing of this offseason in the league, or were there maybe one or two others that may have been less palatable?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly in the conversation. I'm probably still partial to the Timofey Mozgov contract because it's really hard to defend that one.
Dude, four years at that price at 20, he'll be 30 next season.
Yeah.
Like the Evan Turner deal, you can look at the money. Maybe that's comparable to Mozgov, but he's 3 years younger.
Well, and the timing of it too, at least with Evan Turner, some time went by. With Mozgov, the Lakers are like, yeah, we're getting him for sure.
And the other thing is that alternative cost we talked about earlier. I mean, there was, you know, the free agent that maybe they could have signed someone who would have been better this summer. But, you know, in the Lakers case, you're tying up valuable, extremely valuable cap space that takes them out of the market for max guys in future seasons for Timofey Mozgov.
I have no clue what they're, I mean, I guess anytime we can bring up the Lakers in a negative light, we should probably take that opportunity. I have no clue what they're doing, because you have Randall, Russell, you know, Crawford. These guys are all, what, 23 and younger. And then they sign Luol Deng and Timofey Mozgov, both guys who are going to be on the other side of 30 this summer. I mean, I don't really understand what the plan is with that nucleus there.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to understand how much of that was the whole, you know, Jim Buss, we're going to get back into contention in the next few years here. How much of it is them feeling they like they wanted some adults in the room? I think signing one of those guys or a couple of lower price guys. I mean, I contrast what the Lakers did this year with what Phoenix did this summer, where they got Jared Dudley, a guy who is going to be in a good role for him. Someone who could step aside as their young players, their draft picks this year, Marquise Chris and Dragan Bender, develop into starters. And he's a great locker room guy. And they got one of the better value contracts this summer for him. So then their other veteran pickup was Leandro Barbosa, who's on like a two-year contract with the second year only lightly guaranteed. Those are the kind of contracts you do when you're trying to get veterans, not, you know, $16 million a year from Mozgov and $18 million a year for Deng.
And not to harp too much on the Lakers, but didn't Jim Buss have like a self-imposed ultimatum that if they weren't contending in X amount of years that he would step down? Haven't we passed that point now?
I've done a lot of research into this for a piece I worked on in the spring, and it was kind of nebulous the time frame he was actually talking. It could have meant by this year, but it sounds like probably by 2017-18 is when the actual deadline is. So we'll see.
I think we've met our quota for Laker bashing this episode. So let's move back to the Blazers. I want to talk about Damian Lillard, because you're a guy who, you know, you look at and in your articles, you look at a lot of advanced stats. I mean, you mentioned doing the real plus minus predictions. I mean, that's pretty heavily based on statistics, but also, you know, you're watching dozens and dozens of games in person of NBA basketball every single season. So you're seeing this up front, and you're pretty familiar with the Portland Trailblazers. So, you know, taking in that, the eyeball test with all of the statistics that you're so familiar with, looking at Damian Lillard, do you think that on each side of the ball, how close is he to his ceiling as an offensive player? And also, how close do you think he is to his ceiling as a defender and improving as a defender?
I mean, that's interesting because offensively, you know, point guards do have a tendency to develop later than guys at other positions. You know, you see them make bigger jumps in their mid-20s. I mean, he's just already so good offensively that I don't know how much better he can get. I mean, I think the big thing would be if he married kind of his finishing from 2014-15 when he really improved in that regard with his three-point shooting from last season. If he put those two together and had a season where high volume and, you know, he was about an average efficiency last year. If he was high volume and then above average efficiency, that's probably his ceiling offensively. I just don't know how much better than that he can get. Defensively, it's interesting because, you know, it was really the spring of 2015 where all of a sudden it seemed to be like, forget James Harden, Damian Lillard's actually the worst star defender in the league. And at that point, I thought it was pretty harsh because his advanced stats were pretty good that year, and he had shown a lot of improvement. He had really dedicated himself at that end of the court. I mean, I did an interview with him for an ESPN The Magazine piece in, you know, I think it was maybe early March of that year, where that was one of the key talking points, was how much he had improved defensively. And obviously the loss of Wesley Matthews really seemed to hurt him. He didn't have, you know, that ability to cross match quite as much. And, you know, he got exposed a little bit more. You know, playing with CJ McCollum now, it seems like that's just going to kind of be a relatively permanent state. I mean, I don't think it's a lack of effort in any regard on Lillard's part defensively. It's I think it's more physical in terms of just he gets picked off really easily, it seems like, by screens because of the fact that he's a relatively slight guy, even though, you know, he's not necessarily a small point guard. He's just kind of slight. And I don't know that that's ever going to go away. I mean, he's really improved as a post defender, but, you know, there's only so much you can do in that regard. So I think actually he's probably relatively close to his peak at both ends of the not close to his peak in terms of results defensively, because again, if he was paired with someone who was a bigger defender who could help him out a little bit more, I think the results would be better. But in terms of, you know, kind of, is he going to make physical or mental improvements? Probably fairly close to peak at both ends.
So you mentioned in the 2014-2015 season, he finished a lot better at the rim than he did last season. And I think I'm just going off the top of my head here, but I'm assuming a huge part of that was the amount of big men that LaMarcus Aldridge was able to draw out of the post and kind of clearing up the middle for Damian Lillard to finish. I'm assuming the attention that LaMarcus got from opposing defenses was a big part of Dame's success at the rim that year. Do you think that hypothesis holds any water?
I mean, it's certainly a reasonable theory. I mean, you know, the one thing is, when you went to Aminu at power forward, you still were getting a lot of that floor spacey effect, even though, you know, obviously he's not the offensive player that Aldridge is, but just because of the fact that you're stationing now four guys around the three-point line on most plays, or three guys if Lillard's driving. So, you know, it'd be interesting to take a look at that and see how much of the effect, you know, how well he finished with Aldridge on the court 2 years ago as opposed to with him off.
Do you think the Blazers, you know, looking at everyone on the roster and the amount from the last couple seasons, I mean, 3 years ago, I believe, you know, four out of the five Blazer starters were legitimate threats from 20 feet and beyond. Looking at last season, there were a couple of guys who had reputations for not being so good at stretching the floor, but Aminu and Henderson, those guys kind of exceeded what we expected from them. This season, do you think that the Blazers have some legitimate threats in their offense to spread the floor besides Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum? Or do you think maybe that the Al-Farouq Aminu performing so well from outside, do you think that was kind of maybe a bit of a mirage?
Well, I mean, anytime someone improves as much as he did, I think you kind of, my inclination is to project that there's going to be some sort of regression towards his mean. You know, I think that doesn't mean him going back to, you know, being a 25% three-point shooter or whatever like that, but, you know, if he's settling in and, you know, in the low 30s, that might be a likely possibility. I mean, this brings up an interesting question, which to me is one of the more interesting questions that the Blazers going into the season is kind of, now that Aminu is settled in at power forward, who is the best option at small forward for this team alongside with the rest of the starting lineup? I mean, you know, Turner obviously got the big contract. He's someone who can provide another playmaking option. Crabbe is by far the best spacing option, stretching option in that role. And then you got Harkless, who I think has kind of been ruled out of this competition just because of the fact that he was signed so late and for so much less money than those other two guys. But in some ways, I think he might actually make more sense with the starting lineup just because of the fact that Crabbe defensively, it's always going to be an issue if you put him out there with CJ and Dame and have such an undersized trio of guards in on the perimeter. And then Turner, I mean, I do think you probably want him coming off the bench to run the second unit offense. So I'm really curious to see how that shakes out in training camp.
Do you have faith that Terry Stotts can do with Evan Turner what he did with Al-Farouq Aminu in terms of putting in a position to hit those kind of open shots that he gets? Because Turner might have an even worse reputation as an outside shooter than Al-Farouq did coming in.
I think he does. And I mean, you know, if he's going to do it, Portland is probably the place, I guess. You know, I mean, unless he ends up in like San Antonio or someplace like that with a great track record of shot development. But I'd say at this point in his career, even though, you know, it's not much that much farther than Aminu's career, I'm pretty skeptical that it's going to happen because, you know, I think he's probably got more form-related issues in that regard than Aminu did.
And related to that question, something that I hear quite a bit is that Terry Stotts gets his players to overachieve. In your view and in the data, does that suss out? Does Terry Stotts get substantively more from his players than those players maybe on other teams? Or is that just sort of a kind of a Portland narrative?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting aspect of looking at last season, because, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is last year's RPM projection for the Blazers had them at 40 wins before the season, which was obviously way higher than Vegas, way higher, I think, even than most people in Portland were thinking going into the season, and higher than I thought subjectively. So, you know, I think he got a lot of credit for those players, the way that the team outperformed what the outside world was expecting. And some of that probably should have gone to Neil Walshay and going out and getting guys like Aminu, like Ed Davis, who had pretty good statistical track records that ended up translating into bigger roles. But, you know, the word that Neil has used with Stotts is an empowerer. And I really like that because he like gives guys the freedom to do more. I mean, we saw that with Nicola Batum when he took over, a guy who had been stuck in the corner as a 3-and-D specialist under Nate McMillan, and then got the opportunity to handle the ball a lot more and really set up what he eventually did to a greater degree even in Charlotte because of the fact that he had just less other players to compete with him for the ball. And last year, to me, Plumlee was the ultimate example of that. Nobody knew this guy could dribble and pass. He didn't do that at all in Brooklyn. Like, when they got him, I was like, okay, that's a great fit because he's just going to roll hard off pick and rolls and dunk. I had no idea that, you know, he was going to become one of the better passing big men in the league. And so I think those are good examples of what he does. So, you know, now as you project that forward, the guy like Evan Turner, that's interesting because I think, you know, he generally teams have kind of like Boston built their lineup a little bit around what Evan Turner was doing in terms of putting the ball in his hands. So I don't know if necessarily he can come to Portland and be put in a better position to succeed.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, we're just going to have to wait and see because, you know, with the success of last season and bringing everybody back as opposed to what we kind of thought was going to happen before last season and bringing Evan Turner in and then Festus Ezeli, I mean, it seems like Terry Stotts is not going to have an easy time coming up with a consistent rotation that really plays each and every one of these guys to the best of his individual abilities.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good problem to have, certainly. You'd rather have more depth than too little depth. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Just as much as I was talking about how the small forward rotation shakes out, what's the back end of the rotation look like? Because you're probably not going to play more than 9 guys most nights, maybe 10, you know, from time to time. And there's going to be someone with a track record of being a rotation caliber player who, you know, might end up out of it when, especially in the front court, if Aminu is a full-time power forward and then you're trying to find minutes. I mean, Noah Vonleh is, you know, the obvious guy who's probably going to play a smaller role than last year when he was starting most of the season. But, you know, even between trying to find minutes for Myers Leonard and then the three centers, all three of those guys along with Aminu, that's probably too many in a rotation. So it'll be interesting, especially if Ezeli is healthy. So that's kind of the wild card there.
Well, that's something I've wondered. I mean, is Noah Vonleh, is he going to see the floor at all next year?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. I think he's really going to have a strong training camp to carve out a role for himself. And, you know, maybe the other thing that happens is, you know, if there's an injury in the perimeter, you might see Aminu end up playing more minutes at small forward there to kind of compensate. And that's a way that you create some more playing time in the front court. But yeah, it's a tough spot for him, especially because of the fact that the focus has changed from, you know, the development we talked about last season to now the focus is clearly on trying to win.
So I want to wrap here, Kevin, before we go, talking a little bit about kind of a topic that's certainly interesting to Brandon and I and people who, you know, follow Blazers Edge and follow the Blazers really closely, because I think one thing I've kind of started to notice, and I might, you know, I'm this being a Oregon Ducks fan as well might play into this too with their kind of success and seeing that fan base as well. But I feel like with the Trailblazers, you have Damian Lillard and the hashtag they, the kind of underdog personality they take. Brandon Goldner, for the listeners, is showing us his Never Doubt Rip City t-shirt. I mean, so I think that's all kind of indicative of the personality of the Trailblazers as a team. And I feel like fans have sort of embraced that role as underdogs, sort of to when there's a slight taken against their team, it's taken a bit more viscerally and a bit more personal than, you know, perhaps some other fan bases. So this is what I wanted to end asking you is being a guy who covers the NBA on a national level and who's been doing it for, you know, the better part of a decade here, getting your feedback from NBA fans across the spectrum here, are different fan bases, do they react differently when national writers are critical of their team? Or is every single team just have that kind of attachment to their team?
I would say yes and no. First off, I mean, I do think Blazers fans, the fact that, you know, for a long period of time, the Blazers were the only professional game in town until the Timbers came around in the last few years and started to vie for attention a little bit. You know, there is a closer connection. I think that whole, you know, the Portland soccer moms joke that Bill Simmons has made, that has some merit, certainly. There's a protective nature because of the fact that it's such a close relationship between fans and the team. And then I think the other aspect is, you know, being a relatively small market, being on the West Coast, there's kind of a natural assumption, oh, the national media just doesn't care about us out here in Portland. Like, you know, I mean, honestly, I remember feeling the same way about the Sonics in the 90s when they were in competition with, you know, whether it was Houston and Phoenix and Chicago and New York or whoever, the Lakers, when they came up later in that decade. Like, oh, well, nobody wants the Seattle to succeed. Obviously, they'd rather have the Lakers succeed. I think there is definitely an element of that, but here's the funny thing is I feel like oftentimes on Twitter I hear, and by the way, even though I've been doing this for like more than a decade, it's only since Twitter existed that I've really heard about it. But sometimes you hear both from small market fans who are like, oh yeah, no, the national media doesn't care about us. And then you also hear from large market fans who are like, well, the national media just wants to tweak us to get a rise out of us. So that's why the Knicks are projected for 35 wins in RPM, not because Derrick Rose just does have a terrible RPM projection for next season. So, I mean, I think the big thing is, you know, in 2016, there's probably still a few national media types who are kind of still subscribing to that, you know, 90s mindset of only watching the national games and having a limited view of the league. But I think most people are more in the vein of someone like me who's, you know, I've got a spreadsheet where I try to track the number of game times I watch each team, and I'm trying to make sure that that's relatively equal. You know, it's never going to be exactly equal, particularly for the Blazers. I'm always going to see them more. But, you know, it's definitely a focus on having it being a 30-team league. So, you know, I hope people respect that most national writers, I think, are trying to do that same thing.
Nice. Yeah, it's good to hear. I mean, it's validating to hear, because I already kind of assumed this, but it's validating to hear how much of an effort, you know, national reporters make to actually take an objective stance. And there's 30 NBA teams on any given Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday during the NBA season. How many games are there a night? I mean, you can't literally watch every single team, every single game. And I feel like that's kind of the expectation that fans sometimes put on national reporters.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people raise a point that is both fair and unfair. They're like, well, you know, there are things you notice watching a team night in and night out that you just can't if you're parachuting in every couple of weeks. And A, that's true. And I think, you know, in Portland, I enjoy that benefit because of the fact that I'm closer to the team than, you know, I am almost anyone else. But the other aspect is, it is, if you are watching your team 80 times a year or whatever it is, like a fan of the Blazers, you're probably not watching, you know, if you're comparing Damian Lillard to Kyle Lowry, let's say, or LaMarcus Aldridge to Kevin Love back in the day, you're not watching that other guy nearly often as often enough to know the little things that fans in their city would know about them. So it's kind of tough to make that comparison, you know?
Definitely. It's an interesting dynamic. And now with the way that social media is and the access that everybody has to, you know, people creating the news, it's certainly different from, I would imagine, when you got into this over 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool because of the fact that as a writer, you're kind of putting something out in the world and you just have no idea. It's like, did this work? Did this not work? So having that feedback is really awesome, I think, probably at least 90% of the time.
All right, Kevin. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show this week, dude. We really appreciate it. Real quick before you go, where can Blazers Edge listeners find you on Twitter and on ESPN?
Yeah, so at Kay Pelton on Twitter, then, you know, on ESPN, really, you know, there's no centralized home, but my coverage is on there under ESPN Insider. And then the other place I'll promote here is facebook.com/Kay Pelton. Try to post nearly everything there.
All right, well, Blazers Edge listeners, be sure to check that out. Kevin, thanks again for coming on the show.
All right, thanks for having me.
All Alrighty, we're all done with episode 171 of the Blazers Edge podcast. We'd like to thank you very much for joining us this week. I'd also like to make an amendment real quick on last week's episode number 169 with Casey Holdall, Trailblazers beat reporter. Somehow, during the entire length of that conversation, Brandon and I completely forgot to mention Casey's podcast that he does with Joe Freeman from The Oregonian. That podcast is called The Rip City Report, and you can check that out on iTunes. Also, we'd like to thank very much ESPN insider Kevin Pelton for coming on the show this week.
100% agree. Kevin was awesome. He's welcome back on the show anytime. Per usual, our intro and outro beats are brought to you by Odar. You can check out his work at soundcloud.com/odarbeats. Please be sure to tune in to the Blazers Edge Midweek podcast with Dan Marang and Dave Deckard. And for Chris Lucia, I'm Brandon Goldler. And remember, if you're renewing a commercial driver's license and you have a hazardous materials endorsement, you're going to want to retain that information to pass the hazardous materials endorsement test.
Excellent.